Okay, it's Bob and Cameron again. This is the 17th edition, and it is March 11th, 2021. Okay, Cameron, I think you I think you have a couple of points you want to get into right away.
Well, when we closed off the last time, I thought we were on a very fertile topic, namely in talking about the different figures in the tiny note chart. We had specified that there was a dimension of the what could be called the laws of media, the forms of media, the elementary types of human communication. But then, sort of as sidelights or repercussions or ramifications of that, there were questions of how communication can be affected about those forms. How does education work to sort of go through a somersault in order to receive communication about communication? And then another topic was what flows from the forms of communication? What practical applications are there, both for good and for ill? And then one last topic that comes from the forms is what are the metaphysics of the forms? What do they imply about reality? What are we able to conceive about the world when there is this kind of reflexivity of communication? And the question arose about the, it seemed like all of the different figures of your chart, including yourself, could be thought of in terms of this sort of dynamic gestalt. And so then the question came up, if that's a reasonable way of thinking about the chart, how does the chart work in your own mind, especially in its vertical dimension? How does the chart work as a representation of the big now, of all at onceness?
Right, and are you thinking of McLuhan's early 50s essays on vertical symbolism versus horizontal symbolism when you say vertical dimension?
No, actually, I mean, that actually does come into this, but in a, that's a complicated topic in itself. I was really thinking in terms of contrasting times, the vertical being the all is always now, and the horizontal being chronological time, every moment a change from the moment before.
Oh, that's interesting. So the vertical is the big now, and horizontal is linear.
Correct. Mm. And they can be thought of as a set of forms. It is always the case, a little bit like chemical elements. And then the linear dimension being how these forms are expressed.
Right. So I definitely meant the Android meme, which the chart was an image of the ground when it became figure. The Android meme was ground from 1960 to 1990 and then became figure as the internet. And that's a big now, big resonating sphere, the internet, and maybe even other Platonic solids. So if we use the word vertical for the big dimension, I mean the big now, the linear has happened. It's not, the chart is showing that the linearity doesn't happen anymore. There was this sequence of technologies which from ordinary awareness, you know, went from the telegraph through the various electric media for 150 years. But now it was all mashed into this weird simultaneity. Now, electricity was simultaneous from the telegraph on, but the media themselves didn't show up, and they almost by decade changed the manners of people's communication from the telegraph through telephone, movie, radio, bulldozers, TV, computer, satellite. That was sequential. The figures of the electric media were sequential. And McLuhan, you know, had fun playing with different descriptions and ratios between them. Like he, one where he said, the movie, the manuscript, what was that? The manuscript was to the movie as the something, okay, maybe it was movie to airplane as something else was to something else. This is an article in Take One Film Magazine, 1967. Do you know what I'm referring to?
I know what you're referring to, but I don't
airplane.
Know
the... Airplane is to something as something is to movie. What would they be? It's funny, I've forgotten that. When you're maybe airplane, oh, car is to movie as airplane is to TV. You get that? The car is to movie as the airplane. The airplane had the autonomy to go all over the place and loop and twirl. It wasn't stuck to the road. Just like the movie consumer was stuck in the theater, the television could take you everywhere like an airplane. So do you remember that one?
Well, I don't remember it exactly, but it rings true. And I think it's interesting to try to sort of pull what you're saying apart a little bit, because there's a lot of interesting aspects to it. For example, a car, you're looking out of a moving vehicle through a screen.
Yeah.
So I think you were talking, I think the first comparison was the car to the movie, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So in the movie theater, you're sitting still. You're a paraplegic, as he says, and the screen is in front of you, and what you see is more or less enforced. You don't have any role in what you see.
Yeah.
So you don't have movement either physically or psychologically. Whereas in the car, you have the freedom to go where you want and see what you want.
Yeah.
And so there's that difference. So now, if we look at the airplane. What the airplane was to what, the computer, or what was the
to television?
Television. Okay. So with television, what's happening is that you have the final mechanization, if you will, of all of the human senses, all of human perceptions, but it's fixed. It's in a box, you could say.
Yeah.
And with the airplane, what you have is the ability to look down on, quote-unquote, the whole Earth. And so if we take the whole Earth to be all of human senses and perceptions, the what you have is a kind of automobile-like freedom on the human sensorium that's very much like what the car did to the movie.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
So I have a post on McLuhan's fondness for airplane metaphors and allusions. and similes from even the late 1940s. McLuhan described what he was trying to do as taking an air perspective on the human scene. And that idea of air perspective on the human scene then goes through a lot of changes over the years. And by the 70s, he's very much more concerned with hijacking as his airplane mode than he is some sort of theoretical benefit.
Now, okay, 2 points. He has an exploration number 8, the bird's point of view. That's visual space. In the electric environment, you couldn't be a bird. So a plane could be seen as a bird, but also it might be inside an environment that you can't get perspective on, especially if the pilot starts looping and going in different spirals. So McLuhan only did the bird point of view when he used the book. The book provided the bird point of view, but other media did not provide the bird point of view. And then the other thing, talking about birds' views, you brought up hijacking. Oh, yeah, the thing about the airplane. When the guy, it's in the movie The Right Stuff, I think, that was based on the book by Tom Wolfe, McLuhan's friend, the pilots were trying to break the sound barrier or light barrier, whatever it was. What would it be, the sound barrier?
Yeah. The light barrier is pretty hard to break.
Yeah. Okay, so they're trying to break the sound barrier, and they kept crashing. Finally, somebody pushed the whatever was on the handle, whatever they called that, the jockey stick, I guess, pushed the jockey stick backwards, counterintuitive, and it worked. It somehow got through the sound barrier without crashing. Do you know about that? You remember McLuhan writing about that?
Oh, I know he wrote about it. I think the guy that did it was Chuck Yeager.
Yeah.
But I don't remember the counterintuitive use of the jockey stick, no.
Yeah.
But that sounds... McLuhan would like that a lot, taking a kind of reverse view of things in order
you
to
had
see
to,
how they...
So in television, everything is upside down compared to previous media. You're involved. You're the screen and all that. Mm-hmm. The viewer's the screen. So this weird flip that was happening with television, it broke into a new zone. It broke the tactile barrier, you could say, and that was similar to the airplane doing this reverse tetrad on itself to accomplish going faster and breaking the sound barrier.
But that's very much related to the whole question of the vertical in your chart, because the in order to have a, I don't want to use the word grasp, I don't want to use the word view, in order to have an understanding, I guess that's not a bad word, in order to have an understanding of the vertical dimension, of the all-at-once dimension, of the now dimension, there has to be a kind of flight. But that flight has to be one that remains anchored in what is seen. And so the big difficulty of describing the vertical dimension is that the understanding is, on the one hand, it's at a distance from what is understood, namely the possibilities of human perception. But on the other hand, it itself is a possibility. It's a manifestation of a human possibility. And so describing this distance and identity has been a huge problem in the history of philosophy. It's been known as a problem for at least 2.5 millennia, if not more. It would be interesting to know if you were thinking at all about this sort of stuff in terms of the chart. I mean, is the fifth point of view, which is your point of view, obviously, on the one hand, it is a point of view, and on the other hand, it takes a distance. It's the fifth, not the first, the second, the third, or the fourth. It's something different, but somehow part of the same array.
Yeah, so what some of the ratios I was thinking of, emphasizing the people, McLuhan, LaRouche, Croker, and Thompson. You had two Americans, LaRouche and Thompson. You had two Canadians, McLuhan and Croker. LaRouche and Thompson, the Americans, are Platonists. McLuhan's an Aristotelian. Croker wrote about Thomas Aquinas and Aristotelianism, so he's probably neither, but he's closer to Aristotle than Plato in his work. So the two Canadians were Aristotelians, and the two Americans were Platonists. Then you look at the media of each quadrant. So LaRouche's newspaper, McLuhan is electric media, this is on the chart, Thompson is printed book, and Croker is movie. So newspaper, LaRouche, American Platonist, Thompson, printed book, and Platonist. So the Americans are Plato, which might resonate with the description of Americans as Kantian. McLuhan in the 40s said all Americans are Kantian. And he was a guy who went into transcendence and inner space or something mystical or metaphysical as an anti-environment to the increasing materialism, I guess, of knowledge around him. So the Americans are newspaper and book, and McLuhan is electric media and movie, which are electric. So those were another bunch of ratios.
We need to be, if anybody happens to listen to this, we need to remark that these categories, Platonist, Aristotelian, Kantian, these are very rough, fairly unconsidered categories, right? So they can be used to indicate sort of rough differences, but once they're probed at all, they're the sort of categories that must be left aside and in the search for better ones.
Yeah, they're products of the Gutenberg galaxy, maybe the alphabet before that, but they're products of visual space, these categories. And so McLuhan only made categories as ad hoc temporary probes.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And, you know, Eric said about a year after Understanding Media came out, Marshall said, you know, this hot, cool thing ain't working. We're ditching it. Now, for the public, that's one of the metaphors that attracted people's attention, this hot, cool thing. And they're still debating it, what it means, what was the difference. But McLuhan and Eric, it dropped it. And but not if someone brought it up. But there Eric did report this, that it wasn't useful. He didn't like it. He found it too mixed up or complicated. So maybe that's when he moved to cliche archetype with Wilfred Watson.
Well, I think the year 1964 is significant because just after Understanding Media was published is when he read Kohler's Gestalt Psychology.
Figure ground.
And, so he always maintained in the last 15 years of his life, he always maintained that figure ground was the sort of the main conceptual tool he was working with.
Yeah.
Cliche and archetype, another opposition that he considered very important, just like eye and ear. McLuhan, his whole life long, tended to work with rough oppositions that he didn't want to take as antagonistic or as only antagonistic. He wanted to see their interplay as well.
Yeah.
And how to do that was one of the big questions of his entire career.
So what was, and then, you know, he had Daniel Capon designing the computer patterning of sensory thresholds, his goal.
Right.
What would he use as categories in that? Is there anything written on that?
He came to realize that was a whole cul-de-sac that wasn't going to get anywhere, because the problem with that is that either the senses could be taken literally, or if they were taken not literally, then it was very hard to understand how you would ever get experiments going. So, for example, as soon as you say that TV is ear, not eye, or that symphonic music is eye, not ear, you're beginning to use senses in a non-literal sense, and it becomes very hard to try to deal with them in a mechanistic or experimental way.
Mm.
And he saw that fairly early on, maybe between 1958 and 1965, something like that. He was probably bending to everybody's demand for concrete results and mm-hmm. concrete demonstration.
Mm.
And so he was kind of tending in that direction. And I think he finally thought, oh, hell with that. That doesn't make any sense.
But he did talk about it. He had to use it to pretend he had some practical application of it.
Correct.
You know?
Correct. Because there were, first off, he had some financing through the CBC and I don't know where else. But people were interested in that question.
Yeah.
And if they were interested enough to finance it, then he was interested in it, right?
Yeah.
But not because he thought the question itself was interesting. The financing was interesting.
Yeah. And so, yeah, he's talking about it in the Playboy interview. And I always liked his point. He said, just as we manage economies in a, totalitarian way, individual choice was not the people didn't vote on how the managers of Keynesian economics managed Wall Street or whatever. He thought, well, let's make it broader. As we manage the economies in visual space and credit, I guess, they are subject to media dynamics that change the rate of inflation or stagflation, all
sure.
those things that happen. So it was, he said, why can't we consider the management of media environments as not an infringement of our rights? They're important. So maybe that was
He didn't mean by that they should be imposed on people in a sort of totalitarian way. What he meant was that these are things which are dominant in human society and in human individual psychology, and they must be recognized as dominance and researched as dominance, right? And
yeah.
From his point of view, that research could and should involve everybody in the society.
Yes.
We should be probing our ignorance. We should be looking for that one man in a million that might know the answer to some key problem that nobody else does.
Yeah.
So all of those things are very far from totalitarian imposition. The totalitarian imposition part just comes up when you consider that these things are already imposed, but totally unrecognized.
Right. Whenever I brought it up with maybe a professor or something, they go, that's rather fascist. They thought you should be able to watch TV whenever you wanted to. Now, the interesting,
correct,
McLuhan's reasonableness about it all was that television wouldn't be wiped out. It would be only put on hiatus for 6 months, and then you'd bring it back in, and then you'd see what the effects were, and now you'd be ready to look at them. And then you'd do that for 6 months, and then you'd maybe turn off radio or newspapers. It would be flexible. You know, you'd be turning on and off the environments. And that's complementary to his image that the average person went from radio to newspaper to book to movie to different foods throughout the day. He rotated through media environments.
But you and I have a different take on what McLuhan was doing when he was talking about 6 months of this and 6 months of that and stuff. I think he was just talking in an attempt for people to begin sort of kindergarten level to understand that there was something here that needed to be investigated and needed to be managed. I don't think he was talking in, as if we knew so much about this that we could just go into Venezuela and begin manipulating the media dials or something.
Yeah, but he did say it, so that could have been satirical. He was commenting how the economy was done that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but he didn't believe it. He didn't believe that the economy should be just imposed on people either. You know, when his inflation articles in the New York Times in the 70s are about the investigation of inflation and looking at it with new eyes and trying to understand inflation in a bigger picture.
Yeah, and moving it out of anthropomorphic projection, you know, the Jews did this or the globalists are doing this, you know, get out of the tribal conflicts that were naturally produced and move towards an understanding that might cool people down a bit about who's it wrong and who's exploiting who.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Personally, I believe that McLuhan in the 70s talking about inflation is this is the result of maybe 30 years or more of kind of percolating in background mode what Carl Jung said about inflation in terms of personal psychology. Back when McLuhan was reading Jung in the late 30s and early 40s, for Jung, inflation is what happens when people identify with archetypes, but they don't identify consciously. They are taken over by these powers and become inflated. And I think there were various aspects of Jung that McLuhan thought were potentially interesting, but not necessarily in the way that Jung had developed them.
Yeah.
And so he kept thinking about these things. And I think his 70s take on inflation owes something to what he'd read all these decades before in Jung, where the inflation is a kind of compensation for weaknesses. And in McLuhan's inflation articles, he brings out that compensation aspect, the fact that inflation seems like it's something big, but it's actually something small, and it actually is compensating for weaknesses. A kind of an interesting application of individual psychology to the social matrix.
Yeah, so I always thought it was beautiful the way he said on page 31 in the Counterblast, the archetypes of the social unconscious are the environments. So the effect of the archetype in humans as an unconscious force or environment, he concretized. It wasn't this nebulous stuff about the archetypal male and the archetypal female, though they were there, but that was the older media. He updated Jung to deal with the archetypes of new possessing forces or unconscious processes. I think he really did complete psychology with that.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree with you. That's exactly what he did. He took something that Jung had thought about in one context, and he, McLuhan, continued to think about it percolating over the years, and eventually it came out in terms of environment and in terms of trying to think about the collective in a new way. Right, we talked about this last time about how for thousands of years people tended to think of societies and mobs and collectivities more or less as individuals.
Yeah.
And one of the interesting aspects of McLuhan is that he tried to get away from that. Joyce was definitely a big influence in that regard.
Do you know the quote that, encapsulates that thought process? What comes to mind? In Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah, enlighten us.
Yeah, page 112, I think it is. Lead kindly foul. And foul included F-O-U-L-E, French for crowd.
Yeah, interesting.
And he has that quote in War and Peace, I think, and maybe in another place. It was one of his favorite quotes. So, but, lead kindly crowd.
Fowl is the hen.
Yeah.
Namely the one of Finnegan's Wake. But there's also a very interesting thread in McLuhan's work talking about the need for the disharmony of the personality, right? He keeps talking about how in Greek tragedy, if you don't have the the sin, the fault of the protagonist, then you can't have the unfolding of the tragedy.
Hamartia.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Without the Hamartia, then there can be no widening of the consciousness.
Right.
So the foul also relates to that.
Yeah.
And through that to Hamlet.
How's that in Hamlet?
Well,
is he the one who says that?
About
lead kindly something? Does Hamlet say that?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I don't know the answer to that. I was just thinking that they're walking on the battlements before the ghost comes, they're talking about the foul air.
Mm.
And I think Hamlet at one point talks about the foul specter, the foul apparition, or something like that.
Right.
I'd have to look it up. But I think all of these things kind of hang together, and especially they do for Joyce in Finnegan's Wake. The demand is always to try to clarify these things through further research. including research into how they hang together.
Yeah. The quotes in War and Peace in the Global Village littered through the book from Finney's Wake are his favorite quotes.
Correct.
It's an inventory of the quotes that can support his interpretation, translation of Finney's Wake. So they're carefully selected. If you memorize those, 30 quotes or whatever's in the book, and look up the areas where they are, get to know those areas, you can master Finney's Wake in a pretty interesting way that would surprise other people who wouldn't know to look at it through that sensory metaphor that McLuhan uses. So I've always recommended to read those Finney's Wake quotes first if you're just starting to explore the book. Look at the ones that McLuhan highlighted.
They're right. That's an interesting thought for sure.
Yeah.
Have you ever looked up how many of those quotes are misquotes?
No.
I haven't either, but I'll bet there's a minority of them are probably wrong.
Yeah, he was cavalier about that. He would quote things. He'd get things wrong, say them in the opposite way, and he wouldn't even give attribution sometimes.
Correct. Lots of times.
But I think that was intentional. An oral society, you didn't get time to deal with the details. You know, just get the wisdom out there.
Maybe. But, you know, Bob, all of this relates to how we started off talking about the vertical dimension in your chart and then getting into flight and having a aerial view of the territory. The territory of human possibilities and stuff. So what we're talking about here with Finnegan's Wake, with what might be called the cloud of implication that characterizes everything in Finnegan's Wake, that relates closely to the whole question of I hate to say the word perspective, but the perspective that you take in the tiny note chart, the hovering, if you will, relates to these questions of the cloud of implication, the mirror back and forth of understanding, the range of understandings.
And the bias, it was consciously said, okay, this is on a piece of paper. I would hand out the piece of paper. I did it at a conference in Banff in December 97. This is the bias of a piece of paper flattening and, complex multi-leveled Orphic Baroque spirals. And it's similar to McLuhan saying, what's the role of the book? In the 50s, what can be the purpose of a book in this new situation? So in the beginning of the final chapter of Finnegan's Wake, which becomes the first chapter, circles back, he says it's about this chart. This hand pulls forth a chart. That was the inspiration for me. It's like, lo, the hand and the chart are manifest. Look it up, and it's at the beginning of the final chapter, which is going to become the beginning of the book. And it's right there. And so Joyce probably referring to his own charts he made, ironically, or it was a new heraldry, a new iconography from medieval perspectives presented with the bias of it consciously intended and explained.
Mm-hmm. Well, it couldn't be without bias because the topic was biases.
Yes.
Right? It would be absurd.
It was like me saying, you think my fallacy is wrong. It was a fallacy to put this stuff on a chart.
Sure.
But you would explain that it was a fallacy. It was a correct fallacy. because it was the only way you could get a perspective, you being a literate, biased American or Western person, this is your only way to get a handle on what's happening. And then you would move yourself, you'd study the processes in each quadrant, the sensory ratios, and move yourself away from the chart.
Yep, yep. So maybe what we can do is begin to move from there over to your book.
Yeah.
My take is that the chart is an interesting take, but it's a very personal one, and it didn't leave you with a way of sharing a mode of investigation with others, or if it maybe was a mode of investigation that you could share with others, but that sharing never eventuated.
It's used a lot on my radio show. And people say, "Well, okay, I'm going into the Thompson quadrant now." People use it, and Ion really uses it. He plays with it. Yeah, Ion said that McLuhan ransacked Innes, and Ion ransacks my chart. He's really good at using it and explaining it or talking about it. So it is used, you know, and people, once they get familiar with it, they like using it. Is that what you mean? You weren't, so you'd have to say, "No, I wasn't aware that it was." Or are you saying it's too personal on another level that can't be used?
Well, I think I was saying both. I certainly wasn't aware that it is used by people. there's a difference in how we use the word "use," right? What McLuhan was trying to get at was something that could be learned in school and applied out of school. And then between the out-of-school application and the in-school learning, there would be a kind of back and forth. And in that sense, it would be like chemistry.
Yeah.
So I don't see that your chart was able to find that kind of use.
Let me say this. So now, later when I developed the five bodies, I did get the five bodies pretty quickly after the chart, a couple years later. But I don't know if I told you, the chemical body is the LaRouche quadrant, the TV body is the McLuhan quadrant, the astral body is the Thompson quadrant, Croker is the chip body, and my quadrant is the mystery body, which mm-hmm. turned out to be Ion. Ion came forth to reveal the mystery landscape. So people mix the body. So you brought up before we start recording the flood here in Maui. Well, somebody posted some news video of it on my Facebook page, and they said, is this Maui in the Thompson quadrant? Because Thompson is the eco-fascism or the ecology thing that comes in between 67 and 72, the Limits to Growth book, he did a lot with that, and the Club of Ruin, or the Club of Rome. McLuhan called the Club of Ruin. But Thompson is a guy considering dropping out and going back to the land, that part of the counterculture, and he did become, well, I made him aware of that, well, you're responding to the Sputnik. You've turned the planet into art form. So that was fun telling him that. And, you know, when, have you ever seen McLuhan's Wake? Yeah, I think you've told me. You've seen McLuhan's Wake, the Toronto-produced film documentary on McLuhan. Well, I attended the New York screening, and the narrator, Laurie Anderson, is that her name? You know, the musician, Laurie Anderson.
Yeah.
She was on the panel, and after we watched it, she then, first thing she said, she says, "That's such a beautiful idea that the satellites turned the planet into an art form and brought in ecology." Like, she was really blown away by that idea. Hadn't thought about it too much, just noticed it while while seeing the replay because she had read it, you know, in the soundtrack. But so that whole ecological thing, which a lot of the baby boomers were biased towards and liked it. Remember, McLuhan said the hippies wore the overalls and jeans and that and beards to get back to their grandfather land. They were trying to become their grandfathers again. And he used to say that the hippies went barefoot because they were trying to touch the ground. That would be the nostalgia for the chemical body ground. But the so that's Thompson is the focus on first nature and trying to preserve it. So and then Ion goes a lot into the Thompson quadrant. Basically, he interprets the Thompson quadrant as a fatalism, that we're doomed and we're going into a dark age, which is what a new dark age, which is what Thompson emphasized. Just thought it was inevitable because it happened before, after major technological breakthroughs. So Ion goes on about how the Thompson quadrant is too fatalistic. And he has a lot to say about it. And we're actually in the Thompson quadrant right now. And it's turned the world upside down. But I won't go into all the details. But it's an example of something, and using my chart and talking about the five bodies. And here's somebody on my, you know, he's somebody who knows nothing about me or my chart, but is looking at my page and sees what? This flood. Is this the Thompson quadrant? It's hubris. You know, they're going to say, Bob, who's Thompson and what's a quadrant? Then I got 20 minutes airtime explaining my chart one more time.
Sure. So the I'd like to bring up the question of
what about the how and what? Let's go into that too. Not sure what you meant, but that was the second question. What is the how and the what? I don't know if it was a chart or what you were referring to.
Well, I can't remember, but it's closely related
to the
question of the vertical.
Yeah.
Because, as we have already said, the vertical is a take on something that includes itself, right? It's a take on a spectrum where its take is part of the spectrum. And how to explicate that is difficult.
Is that the Munsell color sphere on page, 106, 107, just right beside the page that goes into the golden section, the dynamic symmetry of tensions among proportions? You know that thing about the Munsell, M-U-N-S-E-L-L, color sphere where the viewer is inside the sphere, the color spectrum?
Yeah. Yes.
That's what you mean.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's related to the how and the what, because the how comes out of the what, and because the what is plural, the whole question of the how and the what is the question of the possibility of verticality, you could say.
Yeah. Do you remember in Verbi-Vocal Visual Explorations, number 8, the picture of spheres vertical going into another sphere. So the first sphere is cut off at the bottom because it starts to merge with the second sphere below it. And I think there's three nested spheres. You remember that image?
Yes.
Yeah.
Three, one on top of each other. There's sort of two at the bottom and one at the top, and the three of them are interlocked, right?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So what do you think that's about?
I think that's about what we're talking about.
Right.
For example, if we say that the four quadrants of the tiny note chart can be related in all kinds of relations of two to two.
Yep.
right?
Yeah.
Then the question becomes, how does the fifth take on these various relations of twos? How does that work? Well, then we have, instead of having five, then we have three, right? Because the all of the different ramifications of the twos, those are two different spheres, you could say.
Yeah.
And so then the fifth sphere is above it. So that one way of interpreting the three sphere chart is to say that that's a very high level take on the five takes of your
The five quadrants.
Chart.
Yeah,
that's right.
Very good.
Yeah.
And that's the orbic Baroque spirals.
Okay.
Which is the term for my quadrant.
And just enlarge on that a little bit.
Well, you look, LaRouche is the monadic, so he's God. Sex is McLuhan, because he's the triad.
Why is sex a triad instead of a dyad?
Because there's always another person in any sexual relationship. There's always, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's possible to say that, sure.
Yeah, as an ideal or a completing of what your partner isn't perfect. So you have a romantic thing, another image that is a, what do you call them? Aphrodisiac, right?
Yeah.
Anyways, somebody said that. That's what I was thinking of when I brought in there. There's always a third person in any sexual interaction. It's a good quote. So then Thompson is politics, and Croker is consciousness, because the android meme forces people to wonder, what is consciousness? I like the joke that, you know, most of us are just pinheads now. We have a very tiny little bit of consciousness because we don't need much, because the environment does everything for us, remembers everything. See? So the question of consciousness, and then I'm dealing with the spiraling interaction of the sphericalness of each of the previous four quadrants. So that's why mine's called Orphic Baroque Spirals. And Orphic is the orphism of the egg, you know, that early alchemical symbol. And Baroque is sort of like the fractal, where it just spreads all over the place, but then it comes back to some repeating pattern. But it's Baroque is... counter, in McLuhan's writings, counter to the Newtonian bias. The Baroque would show up every now and then in art movements to counter too much perspective or linearity or representation and matching. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, kind of a breaking out of the framework.
Yeah, and so each one of these media is breaking out of the framework of the Gutenberg galaxy. You know, so,
by the way, I can hear a lot of echoing going on. I don't know if that's okay or not okay.
No, it's okay. It's very faint.
Okay.
You know, and when I'm on the radio show, if someone's got a phone line open, it can get really bad. But I hardly hear any echoing. But you might be hearing the other phone we have on, which is across the room. But it's very faint. So I'm not sure what that is. If it is our phones, we can't do anything about it. You know, we can't mute you, and that's what I do on the radio. You mute the guy's phone that's causing the thing, temporarily muted. So we just have to put up with it. So as I'm going through these points, I probably will come back to the chart all the time as we go through the book, because there's all kinds of other factors in here. For example, I have radio as monad, and Holypathic television satellite is triad. Then I have the dyad come after the triad, because McLuhan said the computer reduces us to a two-bit wit. So that's partly why Thompson, it's using these guys' writings and their ideas and their styles as a metaphor. Thompson was a dialectician, like a Platonist. And so he's two, he's dyad, but it matches up with the computer as two-bit wit. in that early phase, 67 to 72. You see, there's, you could say those are Bob's subjective things, but I can quote somebody to show that it is a meme out there that is not just my projection. I chose to use it, though. Maybe that's my personal part. But and then I have Croker is tetrad. And but LaRouche is a Marxist dialectician, so he's a monad, and that's the figure, and his ground is the dyad. McLuhan is triad, but his ground is tetrad, or reverse. If his Catholicism is really important, then triad is the ground. And, you know, and paganism is the secular world, and that's four. That's the tetrad. And Croker, he moves toward technology coming alive and being its old tetrad management. You could say he used the word algorithm. You know, the algorithms manage society, he was writing in the 90s. So he's a tetrad moving toward the pentad, and I'm a pentad. I'm a cyborg in fully involved tech body that's moving out of that into the hexad. So you see that each one pushes into the next one, each quadrant. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah,
those spheres.
I'm much more interested in the structures that you have going on here as opposed to the individual illustrations of the structures. So,
okay, so what is that? I'm trying to show structures. So what is?
Yes.
What do you mean by structures if I just was explaining something that's not structural?
I don't quite understand what
okay.
you mean there.
I always hear
you talking about structures.
Okay, yeah. So you're interested in what I'm saying about the chart?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, okay.
Just, what I am saying is what's, to me at least, what's most interesting about the chart is are the structures and the deployment of the structures.
Right.
And I'm not very interested in how the structures are literally described and ascribed, right? So that's, I mean, the King of Comedy, for example, which I just happened to see that. The King of Comedy as an example of something.
Are you saying you just happened to see the movie?
No. I just, in fact, I don't know that I've ever seen the movie.
Oh, but it's a fantastic movie.
Is that Robert De Niro?
Yes, and he wants to replace Johnny Carson, who's played as a Jerry Lewis plays him. So he wants to take over the talk. He wants to become a major talk show person. Like, yeah, I think he's a failed comedian, but he wants to get the and all that he goes through to do it. And don't want to ruin it, but it's very interesting what happens. It's really clever. 1982. I don't know.
I have to watch the movie for sure.
Yeah.
If I go a couple rows beneath that, I come to Gretzky, Magic Johnson.
Yes.
There's all sorts of associations I can make with those two great athletes. My point here would be that if people try to understand these literal instances of the structures that are going on in your chart, they will necessarily be misled, because it's the ground of the chart
that's trying to be shown.
And it's structural.
Yeah.
Right? And so the literal level of the individual ascriptions, like Gretzky, Magic Johnson, it's a kind of dance, a kind of rap, on the basis of the structures, but what needs to be understood is the underlying structure, but always keeping in mind that the structure isn't abstract. You know, it isn't Platonic in the way you're using
right.
Platonic. It's not Thompson in the way you're using Thompson.
Right.
The structure necessarily expresses itself.
Yeah.
It's dynamic. It comes out of itself, right? And so the reason that the pentad can have a take on the four other quadrants is that the all of the quadrants come out of themselves.
Yeah.
And so the fifth quadrant, if you will, is a kind of gathering of how the other quadrants necessarily express themselves. It just needs to go around and pick up their expressions and bring them together.
That's right.
The chart.
Now, does it help that, do you get a certain mood when you think of Gratzky and Johnson? You should be thinking of late 80s, early 90s. Jim Brown is a 70s guy. Will Chamberlain's a 60s guy. Mickey Mantle, Gordie Howe, sort of a 60s, 50s guy, and Mickey Mantle, definitely a 50s guy. These names are meant to evoke the era, like the 47 to 57, and it's a radio period. It's at the peak of radio, so it has a quality, a smell to it.
Right, but remember, sometimes you say that you're not interested in chronological time, and then other times, like just now, you're trying to specify things in terms of decades and all that sort of stuff.
Right, moods.
Yeah. So, I mean, era, you can think of as a historical time, E-R-A, or you can think of era with, A with an umlaut, R-A, as a kind of air, a perfumed air.
Yeah.
I would say that the if the chart were to be tested, you could say, in concrete time, I think that it wouldn't come out right. It's not about what is the true history of 1970 to 2000 or something like that. It's a chart of the dynamics of structure.
Yep.
And the structure has two different axes. It has an X axis and a Y axis, and one of them is vertical and one of them is horizontal. One is all at once and one is chronological or linear
right.
Time. And the whole key to the thing is to understand the interrelationship of those things.
Yes. Now,
right.
If you know, a person today, well, in the 80s, a young person, 80s and 90s, so they're listening to radio. They don't have YouTube yet. They hear the Beatles. They hear this, that, and we know the decades are from. But the kid doesn't know. It's all new. It's all part of the same 90s experience for them. And the variety of the different kinds of music a kid could hear then, that's partly what I'm showing. That kid doesn't know the music linearly, doesn't have the environments that the Beatles represented. But once you have YouTube, then you get to see the environments. So that changes things in the way the kid is having simultaneity, right? They can listen to any kind of music, but they can get a clue to the decade because the YouTube might show. At least they'd see the style. So maybe they wouldn't know what the decade, what a Talking Heads video They don't know what decade's from, but they know it was a different kind of atmosphere than a Nirvana video, YouTube. So we got some mixture there. And since you don't find, you're not enthusiastic about McLuhan's media management with the computer, are you?
Of entire environment? No.
Yeah. You are saying we're in the cul-de-sac. You don't see McLuhan offering a solution. Or
yes, I do.
You see him offering a solution on some level, so maybe you should say what that is. See if I'm doing that too.
We've talked about my solution in past conversations, but to put it briefly, the medium is the message. One of the meanings of that is that the elementary structures of human experience are what need to be defined in order to open a new era of the investigation of experience. And once we are able to investigate human experience in the same way as we can investigate physical materials, then that science will revolutionize human history, and it will do so for the better, precisely because the lack of an understanding of human experience has led us into an extremely dangerous contemporary situation.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you think you're more accurate, more appropriate, more useful in how you translate McLuhan than any other books or translators in the McLuhan industry. So you think you're on the right track, or you know what the problem is. And you might think that I'm an ally with you on that. How do we make this a new science? You think that your blog is going to become a big deal that will be taught in universities like Darwinism is?
Well, not my blog. My blog is on the way to a new science.
Right.
It's not the new science itself.
How do we get to the new science itself? What is that?
Well, that's exactly the question. We're not going to get there without realizing that we need to get there. And the way that we realize that we need to get there is by understanding the implications of the cul-de-sac in which we exist or fail to exist. So for me, the enormous problems, social and political problems of the world, and the cul-de-sacs of the intellectual world are signposts of our need to go in a different direction. And that those signposts are the thing that can kick-start us into a new way of looking at human beings and human experience.
Do you see any indications that we're getting somewhere on that dream or goal or ambition?
No. I see things as deteriorating.
Right. So if you suddenly were called up by, well, not Joe Biden, he's dead, Kamala Harris when she's president, and she says, I've been reading your blog, I think we need to listen to you for a while. Would you like to come to the White House and speak to the cabinet and different things? Would you accept that offer?
Sure.
And then what would you do? What would you start talking about? What we're talking about? What your blog talks about?
Yes, I think that's right. You could talk about the misdirection of funding, right? I mean, the United States were to spend even a fraction of what it does on supposedly defense, if it were to spend that on the sorts of structures that we're talking about, that would be a great advance.
Well, what are the structures we're talking about that you could spend on? What would we advocate? What would the funds be used to implement? What activities?
Right. So it would need to establish the kind of centers that McLuhan advocated to Robert Hutchins at the, when he was president of the University of Chicago in the 40s.
Yeah, 1946. Yeah.
That's right. And this was taken right from Siegfried Gideon. And the idea is that there are all sorts of very bright people in different aspects of the world who believe in the truth of what they're doing. So biologists and geneticists and chemists and just all kind of mathematicians, and there may even be philosophers or sociologists that actually believe in truth in their fields. But what's necessary is to understand what is common, or what enables something like truth in these various fields. And the precipitate of that would be that human beings can know truth and can apply truth. And that would change everything, because at the present juncture, our economics and politics and education, literally everything, is dominated by the idea that human beings can't know truth, that everything comes down to the exercise of power, the exercise of influence, the exercise of greed, whatever, but not attention to truth and the furtherance of truth.
So people would open centers and have classes, and they'd have to be tested by us to see if they understood how to approach the new curriculum.
There's a kind of cybernetics involved in this. People are assembled who think that they are dealing with truth in their own fields, once they begin to talk to each other, like the culture and technology seminar, we could say.
Yeah.
The usual result of that would be that it wouldn't work, which is what McLuhan found in the middle 50s.
Yes.
So then when he said the medium is the message, what he realized is that they had, it's not the case that a bunch of good minds coming together without focus are going to stumble across or somehow find the focus that's needed. Rather, the focus that's needed has to be why they are assembled, right? And so through this reversal, definition of truth in human society comes to be the heart of the matter. And McLuhan thought that not only could that be defined, but that already was defined by the spectrum of figure ground possibilities.
So these clinics, would they read McLuhan?
Sure, absolutely, but not only McLuhan. There's the reason that McLuhan is interesting is that when you read him, you are led on through his questions to rethink issues. But
yeah.
That's true of Plato. That's true of Heraclitus. That's true of Aristotle and all sorts of other people. So it's certainly not sort of just McLuhan. McLuhan is just one indication of what's possible with all kinds of people.
Yeah, but then what would be the, then we'd go back to normal university, professors offering different content that they favor, different books.
No, but the, yeah, but you see the whole idea is that it's, let's say you have a professor who's teaching Aristotle.
Yeah.
And that professor, he or she, believes that there is something important about reading Aristotle. There's something about reading Aristotle and continuing to read Aristotle throughout your life that represents a kind of fulfillment of human life. There's some relation between doing this with Aristotle and the truth of human being.
Hmm.
So if somebody's reading Aristotle just for tenure or for fame or for whatever, then they're useless for the kind of center that I'm talking about. But
yeah.
If somebody is genuinely attached to Aristotle and attached to Aristotle as somebody who was grappling with fundamentals of human life, then that person can engage with a chemist who is engaged at the frontiers of chemistry with important truths there. And the big question is, okay, if these people in their different spheres can be engaged with truth, how does that apply to all spheres of human living? Right? It's not the case, for example, if we look at a bunch of nuns in a convent in 1870, it's not the case that we've sort of come beyond what they were doing. They were dedicating their lives to something that they thought worthy of that dedication. Well, we have to understand that dedication no less than we have than a dedication to Aristotle or a dedication to chemistry, right? Human beings throughout history in various ways have been engaged with truth. And the great question which the cul-de-sac addresses us with is, well, is all of that bullshit? Are we really at the end of all of this grappling with truth? Are we really just in a cloud of unknowing, in a night of non-truth, or can humans, take a fifth perspective, as your perspective does on the chart? Is it possible to take a airplane view of the different human relationships with truth in such a way as that we now understand how human truth operates in all sorts of different ways in human life, right? How is truth refracted, you could say, throughout human lives in history? And how did we, in our stupidity, come to overthrow dedication of truth into some kind of wandering around aimlessly, except when we blow people up?
And remember, McLuhan said in 1950, we're turning people into human bombs.
Correct.
Yeah, it's not just going and, you know, throwing a grenade at them. They're walking around in a psychological stress where they suddenly, you know, go postal or something.
Sure. And they're also walking around in a sleepwalking, that allows the complete mismanagement of human affairs by governments and corporations and bureaucracies.
Right.
And universities.
Okay, so so Kamala, she give you a budget. You set up little offices across the country, and people could apply to come and be serious and committed to a discussion that would have to have McLuhan books in it, but other things, movies, whatever, and they'd be talking. I can't see how this does anything. Or when you're saying you get people going into truth, how do we know what truth is? And how do you know you're doing it? Unless
okay,
you're just saying you're going to emphasize McLuhan as the most important thing that people should focus on. And
no,
your blog on McLuhan.
Okay. So remember, the question is the medium is the message. And the medium is the atomic structure of human experience.
Yeah.
And the presupposition is that the elements of human experience are not less simple somehow than the elements of physical nature, right? So the idea, the focus of these centers would be what is the elementary structure of human experience? What is the medium that is the message? Right, and the idea to Kamala is, look, if we aren't able to do this, then the our problems are not solvable because all attempts to solve them are necessarily self-interested and ultimately violent. Right? This is the taking the root of the medium as the message is the only way around the cul-de-sac of human enclosure in self-interest.
Right. So you... ever since I first read you in 1999 in the, you know, the George Sanderson forum, you would say that, you know, there's a fine line between concept and percept. Matter of fact, they're intertwined. Didn't you say
right.
things like that?
Yes, absolutely.
You don't agree with the way people use McLuhan and say, well, there's concepts and then there's percepts. You don't think it's
yeah.
that precise of
Correct.
A difference.
Well, Above all, I don't think it's that easy.
Right, but I think that's what I'm doing in my chart here. I've got people and machines and environments, and so it could be there's 322 nouns here, so 322 figures, and the grounds are whatever you think Holopathic Radio Satellite is. That'd be one of the grounds. So page 11 of Take Today, where man becomes, in their present, he said, electrotechnical environment, man becomes both figure and ground. We can't tell who is the figure and who is the ground in my chart. You know, so when you say you're not interested in, I don't know, the names or what I pick, those are personal choices by me, you're into the structure. Well, the interplay of the figure and the structure is pretty ambivalent.
Correct. Correct. So remember that I was talking about a spectrum of figure and ground.
Yeah.
And the way that works is that, according to McLuhan, there's no figure without a ground, and there's no figure that doesn't become the ground to the new figure, which was its ground.
Mm.
Right, so the way the spectrum works is that at one end you have all figure, and the other end you have all ground, and between you have every possible relation of figure and ground, including all of the relations of ground to figure.
Yeah.
Right. So you have a flip. So the in your chart, this gets us back to the whole vertical dimension.
Yeah.
In your chart, there is indeed this a flip relation between figure and ground, and that's what I was talking about as the instantiation or the literalization of the structures, which necessarily go out from themselves. They don't remain just in themselves, right? And it's this, ever since Aristotle, when Aristotle was talking about the dynamics of the Platonic forms, what he was trying to say was, well, if people haven't understood my great master Plato, it's because they think the forms are separate from everything. But in fact, the forms are dynamic. They express themselves into everything that we see.
Yeah.
And so we can't think of the of Plato's forms as sort of being out there and aloof only. They are also right here. So they're like chemical elements that, if you understand chemical elements appropriately, then you understand that they're both things that have very definite properties. They're eminently definable, but they're also in this vast array that we see when we look out the window.
But I don't see the clinics you create. What goes on
what?
In them?
Sorry, the what that I create?
The clinics. I'm calling these places classes,
oh, the,
centers.
Oh, centers.
Clinics.
Okay, yeah. Okay, good. Yeah. So what goes on is the attempt to define the structure of human experience. What is it that characterizes the what's going on with the chemist, what's going on with the sociologist, what's going on with the poet? It's in my reading of your chart, it's what goes on in these centers is what's going on in your chart.
Yes.
You are trying to make systematic sense of a vast array of human experience going from 1840.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
1840 to 1900, something like that.
But yeah.
I mean to 1990.
Yes.
Okay. And I think you'd probably say, although there are these hundreds of names and types of things in my chart, there's actually nothing that happened between 1840 and 1990 that couldn't be in here in some way.
Yes.
Right? The chart is comprehensive.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So when I was talking before about the mistake of literalization, what I meant was that if you can't take any particular thing like Mickey Mantle and think that that characterizes the chart in a certain way. No, it doesn't. What it does is it's an example of the what could be called the outthrow, the utterance, the outering of
yeah.
the structure.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. So in the same way, and I would say what needs to be done at with very big funding and with a great deal of publicity and a great deal of stress on its importance is for people who believe that they're dealing with truth in their own fields to do together exactly what you're trying to do with your chart.
Yeah.
To make collective sense of things. Right? It's like saying either human life in 2020 is lost in a cul-de-sac that can well exterminate human civilization, if not the whole biosphere, or there is something going on in human history that, number one, can be understood, and number two, can be used as a kind of cybernetics, a way of orienting ourselves. Aren't you saying those two things with your chart?
I think so, but I don't know how to involve other people in the sense of there are professors who in different fields who think they're doing what you're saying. They wish they had funding and could spread their clinics about with their content emphasis.
Okay. But remember that you're transposing me into the White House and you're saying, what would be my suggestion?
Yeah.
I don't say that my suggestion would be accepted. I don't say that there aren't people that think it would be bullshit. I don't think that other people wouldn't say, give me the money instead of that stupid idiot. that could all well happen. But if I'm transposed to the White House and if I'm allowed to finance and direct what I think should be financed and directed, then it's a center that attempts more or less what you're attempting in your chart.
Yeah.
And let me also tell you that at one point, I came fairly close to being able to do something like this. And that happened in Germany, and I was able to get people from the church and from very high level of science, very high level of literature to agree to attempt something like this. It got derailed in rather violently, you could say. but when I've had the opportunity to speak to people about what they might do in this direction, then they've been amenable to try. And I think anybody would.
Now, is this at a convention? Seminar? Where'd you do this? How did you meet?
No, I don't want to get into the details of that. But it would be something like what McLuhan proposed to Hutchins.
Right.
It would be either an adjunct to an existing university or a new college. And it would have the task of interrogating whether or not human beings know truth and can direct themselves with truth, right? And really the big, where we are now is we're without truth, we're without orientation, and if we continue down this road, we'll destroy ourselves. So another possible road is to say, well, are we really without truth or are we in some way with truth? And if we're with truth, how can we understand that, teach that, and apply that? And I think McLuhan's answer, although it wasn't only McLuhan's answer, this is what Plato said more than two millennia ago, we need to know the forms of human understanding in order to get a handle on this.
Yeah, so you would start a center and you would definitely have McLuhan books. And then people would read them, and then they would hear you comment on them, and they go, boy, that's not what I got from reading it, because yours would be way more informed than they are, and you've worked out, I don't know, all the different stages of apprehension or possible angles on the thing, even seeing McLuhan as just doing Plato or Aristotle. He's just the philosopher with modern language. How much would you deviate from talking constantly about McLuhan to other stuff? Would you go into Gideon and McLuhan's favorites, Finnegan's Wake and that? That would be part of it.
Absolutely. But I think you have the wrong idea about what would be attempted. The first, it wouldn't be a center where I would try to direct things, and it wouldn't be a center that would try to take somebody like McLuhan as the single guide.
Yeah.
Right? The idea would be to have people who have a notion of the relationship of human beings and human society to truth in their own field, and to try to understand what the relationship is between that notion of theirs and a analogous relation to truth of people in other fields. And it's because the great need is to have a notion of the multifarious relationship of human beings to truth, that multifarious relation to truth that is the goal of these people being brought together. And if they're able to define that, then that's we're entering into a whole new era of human history.
Right?
I mean, sometimes you talk about trying to do that yourself, right?
Yes, I'm interested in your version of me.
Right. My version, just as we have a very different idea of the how the science works, right? Your science is we already have a rough handle on it, and we can begin changing media environments in the world. And mine is, no, there has to be very fine, detailed research that is very much like the research of the physical sciences, and we solve our problems gradually and involving new discoveries and all that sort of stuff. So we have that big difference. But we also have a difference in that for my way of thinking, it's absolutely essential that different ideas of truth be shown as sort of refractions of each other.
Yeah.
Right? So it's for example, in your chart, my whole take from it would be that the quadrants aren't overcome by your view. They're illuminated, if you will, by your view, but they also illuminate yours. Mm-hmm. And there's this back and forth of illumination.
Right.
Right. And the back and forth of illumination, or the in relationship of the vertical and the horizontal, these are takes on human life, which you regard as true,
mm-hmm.
and as something that if everybody believed that a take like you have in the tiny note chart, if everybody believed that it were possible to have a truthful view of human life in terms like this, not necessarily identical to this, but a truthful view of where we are and where we're going, that everything would be different. Right? We wouldn't be constantly at war with everybody. We wouldn't be spending massive amounts on armaments and trying to blow everybody up and do, right? And then trying to reconfigure society and according to somebody's half-assed notion of education or of genetics or of racial stereotypes and all that sort of bullshit, right?
Yeah. It would be an ongoing turn. Education of the clinics would be philosophy. They'd be a constant inquiry without looking for solutions, but
right,
other than inspiration.
Okay, that's true. But remember that science in the physical sciences, the sciences are an ongoing inquiry.
Yeah.
It's not up in the air. It's not philosophical in the bad sense. It's good science has to do with stuff right in front of us, right? And so the science that's needed for human beings, similarly, has to be about everybody's experience in its raw phenomenology, in it, the way it is.
Okay, so if I brought our endless electricity box, we call it Coldplay, to the clinic, would people say there'd be an inquiry whether to implement this technology? What disruptions it would cause. Would that be a valid inquiry in your sense of what would go on at the clinic?
Maybe, but I don't quite understand your question. What kind of box is this?
Well, this is what we have. It's a box, metaphorically. It's a machine that produces endless electricity.
Uh-huh.
So
cold fusion or something.
Yes, it's we call it cold play because it's not exactly like Pons and Fleischmann's cold fusion. A bit different.
Mm-hmm.
And ion helped us make it. So there it
is.
There's the solution. And I am in the middle.
Well, you say it's the solution, but when people have cheap energy, as it's arguable we already have, that doesn't necessarily produce peace and enlightenment.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Yes. I'd have to, your clinic would look at this thing and say, well, what will this produce? What would be the effects? We are doing that right now with the Department of Homeland Security. They know we got it. And they're looking at Texas and problems in the grid. And they don't have any solutions. No one else has come up with anything. We have. So we're doing it. So I'm asking, what would you add? If we brought you in the Department of Homeland Security. What would you add to the conversation that you think you probably feel is not there? It's missing because you don't see what you're interested in anywhere.
Yeah, I just don't. I don't think that there's a technological fix to our problems.
Ah, okay.
Right.
So what is it that is a fix? Talking about what could be?
No, it's a detailed science of human experience.
Now, McLuhan's done a lot of it, hasn't he? Or Finnegan's Wake has done it?
Yeah, both of those are avenues of exploration, for sure.
So the inventory...
They're not alone.
Right. The inventory of... hasn't been written or said yet, would come out of the clinics. We'd have a new inventory.
Well, you're looking for the medium of human experience. You're trying to define it. You're trying to define how human experience is related to truth in a variety of different fields. Including all of academic fields, but also religion or sports or whatever, a little bit like your chart.
Yeah, in all activities.
How are human beings related to truth? And below that question, well, what is the medium of human experience? And using the medium, using the question of what is the medium of human experience as a kind of signpost towards the question of, well, what is it that's common amongst people engaged in what they consider to be truthful occupations?
Right. And I, in my book/pamphlet, is defining the new medium or the medium as tech body, as the tech body, but that may not be what you mean by medium. naming the
Correct.
New hidden ground. So
Correct.
Try to say how my defining tech body is not your point. Distinguish your point from my point.
Right. Well, first off, the medium of human experience is inherently media, plural.
And that's so from that's, gesture to cell phones, say.
Absolutely. All of the above. But
yeah.
But as soon as you say cell phones, or as soon as you say a gesture or something, that's a literalization. Right?
Yeah.
So in the history of the physical sciences, people were well aware of things like copper and gold and silver and tin and iron, all of which are elements. But they had to learn the difference between these things as physical metals that they could touch, that they could work into all sorts of tools and sculpture and all that sort of stuff. They had to learn the difference between that and these things as elements. And that was a very, very difficult difference to ascertain. But when that was ascertained, it was revolutionary for human life. And that occurred,
1800.
I generally say 1800, but the elements began to be identified following maybe 1770, around there.
Yeah. What did you say there?
We're talking about the difference between the medium.
Right.
You were saying that there's the new medium is the tech body. And for me, the tech body, if I understand, I'll understand better when we go through your book. But
yeah.
If I understand the tech body properly, it's the cul-de-sac into which we have gotten ourselves.
Right.
Because we wanted to get there, but that's where we ended up. And it's not even run by us anymore.
Right.
It's something to which we are subject. And the great question is, are we able to extricate ourselves?
Yeah.
And that's my suggestions about the medium as the message are my answer to the question of whether or not its extrication is possible.
But in the clinic, you would start with McLuhan, and then you...
Not necessarily. Could be Plato, could be Aristotle, could be Hegel, could be Heidegger, could be Nietzsche.
Well, it sounds like you're trying to get people back to a philosophical inquiry. You don't see it being done anywhere, for no reason at all. No practical reason. No attempt to become famous or make money or something from it. Is this what nuns did and monks did? Were they doing an inquiry, or were they just praying? And that an inquiry.
Are you saying that I'm putting this forward not because I want to become rich or something? Are you saying
yeah,
that?
Yeah, you said that motive doesn't work in your what you're asking people to do. You want them to inquire.
Well, remember that if somebody is working with silver, let's say, and you're trying to get that person to understand the difference between silver as something that they work and silver as an element, the more they insist on what silver does if you heat it or cool it or hammer it or whatever, the less their understanding that it could also be an element.
So, what do you do with it when it's an element?
Well, it revolutionizes the world. Once you begin to understand the elementary structures in a field, everything is new. Everything is up for grabs,
mm-hmm.
because it has to be rethought. And so if you're talking about the elementary forms of human experience, and there's nothing that isn't human experience, from teaching babies language to debating in the halls of Congress, or people talking in the Pentagon or whatever, all of that is human experience. And right now it's going on in a funhouse, in a ship of fools, in a insane asylum. We don't know what we're doing, but there's huge practical effects, and that's one of the ways in which McLuhan can be used in these centers/clinics. Is that McLuhan was intensely conscious of the human comedy. But the fact now is that the human comedy can easily destroy us all.
Yeah. But would you just have people talking in the clinic, or would they get on the radio and broadcast, use modern media, make YouTube?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And well, remember that in McLuhan's suggestion to Hutchins, what he says is these people need to be very well paid. We can't presuppose that everybody is going to say, well, I'm throwing over my family. I'm throwing over all my perks. I'm throwing over my tenure. I'm throwing over all my existing research to go and talk for free to a bunch of other idiots that are doing that. According to McLuhan, these things need to be very, very well paid and very highly publicized as part of stressing how important these questions are for human life, right? What's happened to modern society is that the most important questions have been defunded. Right, the best minds that we have go into advertising or making movies or doing whatever. What they should be doing, and what if they require great remuneration and great fame, then we supply those. What they should be doing is wondering about the most important questions for human life, namely, even modern people are or are not related to truth.
But universities think they're doing this. They offer all kinds of courses, and everybody explores truth differently, and leads to a lucrative employment. That's the carrot. Not so much now, but the occasionally some of them get somewhere. How are you different from that?
But they don't. Well, there's sort of two kinds of colleges, right? There's colleges that are avowedly religious. Could be Baptist, could be Catholic, Anglican, whatever. And what they say is, we teach the classics. We have a notion of human experience that is centered on the gospel, or is centered on the classics like St. John's in Maryland.
Right.
The problem with all of these things is that they're provincial in the way that Lewis talks about provinciality in American Cosmic Man.
They wouldn't. Wouldn't necessarily agree that they were provincial.
No, of course not. But that's. But the. They are. How can I say? They have shown themselves as unable to spread whatever version of truth they have to the wider society. So they've proven themselves incapable of doing something about the wider predicament.
Okay, so you see nobody's accomplishing what they're claiming to be in the intellectual class.
Well, there's two, as I said, there's two kinds of classes, two kinds of universities. There are the universities that claim to have truth and to bring, to educate students in truth. And then there's the universities that make no such claim.
Mm.
And in fact, they probably couldn't be funded by the federal government if they made that claim.
Right.
Right. They have, they are sort of aloof from any claim to truth, right?
Right.
But what's interesting about these universities is that nobody doing science or math or physics or biology thinks that they are not doing truth.
Mm.
It's only the postmodernists or the crit-lit folks that think they're not doing truth. Right? So you need to get the, you need to have somebody like Linus Pauling that McLuhan talked about all the time. You need to have the Linus Pauling and the Heisenberg and the, I don't know who the leaders are in various fields, but you, the people that are doing good work and believe that their work is truthful, they need to address the question of how can the truth that we believe that we're living in science, how can we generalize that to access to truth for human beings in general, right? So it's if, let me put it this way, because I've been reading, rereading America and Cosmic Man,
right,
and thinking about Lewis and McLuhan together a little bit. In America and Cosmic Man, Lewis mounts an argument for what he explicitly calls rootlessness. Right? Well, human beings are going to become a universal in a way that, or cosmic, in a way that roots them out from all of their traditional truths.
Rootlessness is the word you said. Rootlessness.
Yeah, rootlessness.
Yeah.
And homelessness, right? So Lewis emerges from this book as a champion of sort of human aimlessness, of being part of a great cosmic mass that has no roots in tradition. He wants those extirpated. And so he and McLuhan get together, and every once in a while, I guess, McLuhan tries to say, well, you should be a Catholic. And I think that the two of them pissed each other off.
Yeah.
Over that issue,
yeah,
because it's so fundamentally different from what each of them believed.
Right.
So, in my view, if McLuhan is to be taken seriously, if Plato is to be taken seriously, if Leibniz is to be taken seriously, they need to be taken seriously in a sense that would not avoid Lewis's critique.
Yeah.
They would be trying to show that there is a kind of rootedness and being at home of human beings in the truth in a way that is universal, that's not subject to the sorts of constraints that Lewis criticizes in his book.
So you would have to go to places and intervene. So I'm thinking that when you met McLuhan in 69-70 and heard his case, you then proposed, well, something else, and he
right.
didn't agree. That was your first effort to start your school. You would see if McLuhan would go with you or start a dialogue
mm-hmm.
with you.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's true. I think that's true. It's not a bad way of putting it. Yeah.
Yeah, and you're still trying to do it. Still trying
Correct.
To get some an audience or realize the seriousness. But it does seem that you're emphasizing certain course content, discussion content, Lewis, Gideon, and that, but you would allow other people to do whatever they're doing. But see, you'd have to be the organizer, the guy that says something about what's going on. Because how could you find the people that are doing the real valuable work today? How would you go about doing that?
Well, I mean, in a way, it's self-selecting. I mean, you have MacArthur Fellows, for example.
Right.
So the MacArthur Foundation selects these people that it sees as doing fundamental work, and it funds them.
Yeah.
Okay. So you go to these people and you say, "Do you understand that there's a dearth of truth in human life, and that it is directly related to our problems of war and peace?"
Right.
All right. And of course, as you know, at the end of McLuhan's War and Peace and elsewhere, what he says is we're in the business of trying to define a global city. And the difference between a global city and a global village is that the global village is inherently antagonistic to other villages and is, in fact, inherently self-antagonistic, right? So the global village is no answer to human problems. It's the cause of human problems.
Yeah.
But a global city is one where it's a little bit like the cosmic civilization put forward by Lewis, except that and for McLuhan, that civilization can be rooted, can be truthful. It isn't we're going to suddenly become a new society by eradicating all truth.
Mm-hmm.
McLuhan thinks that's ridiculous, but that's what Lewis puts forward in that book.
Yes.
It's stupid. And it's what Pound, in his letters with Lewis, kept on saying, well, you know, you have the worst kind of fuzzy head. You don't see the economic and social problems and political problems that are right in front of your nose. What's wrong with you, right? And Lewis would say, well, what the hell's wrong with you? You have got all these crazy views of your own. Right? But they were friends.
Yes. Okay, so seems that you think that McLuhan. I was just on a show today with some people talking about this, and I would end up saying that McLuhan completed sociology. He came up with some useful principles that all the citizens should know and could use. He actually came up with something that maybe moved out of the impractical and became practical. Even Mrs. McLuhan said that, I think, in one of the documentaries. She says, it's hard to make it practical, but he is right. So someone finally got correct, got right. And
right.
I was saying
so,
that. And
that's what I, that's
go
what
ahead.
I, in a previous conversation between us, I said that's what McLuhan regarded as the mark of identifying the structures he was looking for.
Yeah.
And the context of him saying the medium is the message, where a bunch of educational lectures that he gave from the middle 50s until, let's say, 1960.
Yeah.
And all of them, he was trying to talk about what's wrong with schools, what can we do practically for schools, what is education all about, and how has it gone wrong? And one of the things that he said repeatedly is that we need to have education that's the same in school as out of school, right? Just like chemistry is not different in a classroom from what a corporation is doing or a factory is doing, we need to be talking about the same thing in and out. So classroom without walls. And that same thing outside the classroom is what you were just talking about as the practical application.
Mm. Right.
Right. So there is no education that works that isn't practical outside.
Yeah. The Practical Mystic, his first essay, 1936.
Yeah.
So maybe, I don't know, there was this Manitoba student paper writings. There were writings before that in 1936.
Right. But not in recognized journals,
just
in student newspapers. Yeah.
Right. So it seems that... You
and
agree
that was
with
Halifax.
Me? Yeah, it started in Halifax. There's a clue there, Cameron.
There,
where are these,
there you
where
go,
the etymology
Halifax
of all this is coming from. What?
The Halifax School
yeah.
of Communication.
he presented himself in Halifax, and they didn't get it. So he had to go somewhere else. So he went to the C1E Review. He went to many, many places and seeds. Nobody got it. Or unless maybe Ted Carpenter got it. Who got McLuhan?
I don't think anybody yet.
All right. So you were saying, do you agree with me McLuhan came up with something practical? So like at the end of Western Search, he actually came up with something. You think an important point is to make McLuhan a major part of the information society and properly explained in some way. Or
sure. Well, the
badly explained, but have other people around who know how to correct it, correct the bad explanation.
Remember, we were talking about the forms of experience, and then we were talking about how they can get taught, the peculiar somersault that's required because the student already has a form or forms of experience, and he or she is going to study forms of experience. And in order to understand that peculiar kind of dialectic involved, there has to be a kind of somersault, and that somersault has to go through a kind of free fall. And that's the great reason that we haven't been able to learn the lessons that already Plato and Aristotle knew 2,500 years ago.
Mm.
But so that's sort of on the educational side.
Yeah.
And then there's the metaphysics of those forms, and then there's the practical application of those forms. And the practical application can be good or bad. It's just their application. So I think that McLuhan will be thought a very important thinker exactly for the sort of practicalities that you were just talking about.
Yeah.
But what are those practicalities that he saw? Right. He before I was talking about how practicalities for McLuhan were a mark of whether or not studies and education were worth doing, really.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
That chemistry is the same in and out, and that's the way humanities should be. But there's another whole sense of the practicalities of McLuhan that I think will be decisive. And that is, McLuhan was not a great theoretical thinker in the same way that Heidegger was, or that Husserl was, or that Hegel was, or that Kant was, etc. But what he was able to do was he had an inherent feel for how these forms of experience were going to play themselves out. So he was able to see in the 1950s what would happen to security agencies.
Right.
He was able to see what would happen to politics. He was able to see what would happen to entertainment. And other people weren't able to see this stuff. No matter how great a thinker somebody like Heidegger was, he could not see beyond about a week from now or something. And here was McLuhan thinking 70 years ahead, And we're able to see that he was able to think 70 years ahead because we're 70 years out.
Yeah.
Maybe if we were 100 years out or 150 years out, there would be other stuff that we would be able to see that now we can't.
Right.
Right? All we know is that McLuhan was able to see what was going to happen with art, entertainment, politics, war, security agencies, and on. And somehow he was able to see this sort of stuff by a kind of second sight. He no sooner saw some medium or some way of thinking than he had sort of had an auto projection mechanism, right? And it turned out to be correct.
Yeah.
And so I think people are going to say, well, if you can know somebody by their fruits, and his fruits were accurate, so they're going to want to know, how was that possible? What was he thinking, and how did he think that those projections could be made?
Right. So your blog is explaining how he thought. You're answering those questions.
I'm trying to. Yeah.
Yeah. So other people who do McLuhan teach it differently. Would that matter? That it's different.
Sure,
they're still emphasizing McLuhan.
Yeah, but the big question that comes out of McLuhan is, how are we to do something about these problems? And his answer to that is the medium is the message, or a revolution in education, or a new study of media. All of these sorts of answers that can be found in McLuhan need to be activated. And what the usual study of McLuhan means is not activating what he recommended.
Mm.
Right? And it happens through a kind of literalization.
Yeah.
If we are going to study media, then we study cell phones and headphones and iPhones, whatever else there is. But that's a literalization, whereas McLuhan was trying to look at, well, what is the medium there? He talks about what is the active force that is structuring what is going on there.
Right. So each quadrant is an attempt to show the medium.
Yes. Right. That's what we said before, is that your tiny note chart is an attempt to think these structures in action.
Yeah.
That
right.
is to say there's structures going on that have a relationship with each other, and there's also a dynamism to the structures that throws out particular examples, right? And so you have these relationships going on that in their interplay end up showing what the world is.
Yeah, now explain in a sentence, then we'll end.
Okay.
The metaphysics angle, what is that? What is that dealing with, if you haven't already been talking about it?
No, I haven't already talked about it, and that's something that I think that McLuhan was able to do in one way better than most folks, and another way wasn't able to do at all.
Mm.
So the way that I think he really saw something that's fabulously important, maybe we can talk about this next time.
Yeah.
Is this the spectrum of figure and ground is kind of like a cloud of implication. And my very poor understanding of Finnegan's Wake is that Joyce treats words and sounds as belonging to a cloud of implication. So what McLuhan says is there's absolutely nothing that we can think about or study or talk about that doesn't have a place in this figure ground spectrum. But that means that if we are going to talk about it precisely, we need to understand it in terms of that spectrum. In other words, what it is not but could be.
Right.
And this is kind of, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. This is kind, you said.
So this is the what might be called the depth dimension to Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah.
There's always a dimension of possibility of how a word or a sound gets generated out of a system of possibilities. And you have to understand that system of possibilities in order to understand the permutations of the word. And through an understanding of the permutations, then you come to understand why Joyce has written it the way he wrote it. So we talked about that in terms of foul earlier.
Yeah, yeah, right? Cool, yeah.
Yeah, so at that level, by insisting on understanding everything in terms of the full range of figure and ground, and ground and figure, I think McLuhan is very good. But if you look at McLuhan's understanding of, I don't know, Plato, let's say,
yeah,
and then compare that to what Heidegger was doing, well, I mean, it's just laughable.
Right? Yeah.
But McLuhan wasn't trying to be what Heidegger was trying to be.
Right.
He was trying to be something different.
So this figure ground, that discovery 65 is what you mean by metaphysics? That's the main theme?
He didn't discover his sense of figure and ground in Kohler. He found in Kohler a way of talking about what he had already discovered and what he was already talking about in terms of center and margin, let's say. And so Innes was already talking about the dynamics of center and margin when he talked about empire. And Innes was intensely conscious of Canada as being subject to the dynamics of center and margin.
Yeah.
Between the United States and England, you could say.
Yes.
So McLuhan was always thinking in terms of what might be called dynamic symmetries from, at the very latest, the early 50s. But he had not...
What happened in the early 50s? I missed that.
Yeah, since the early 50s. But he did not really understand what was going on with these things until the late 50s, and that's what he meant by the medium is the message. That is to say, the dynamics of these symmetries is the medium. And then in 64, when he found Kohler, then he was able to say, oh, okay, these symmetries, we can say, are figure and ground, and as long as we understand the full spectrum of figure and ground relations, then we have something on the basis of which everything in human experience can be understood.
Right, but what happened in the early 50s?
Well, in the early 50s, he came to understand that literature in the book, or the late 40s, better, I guess, the literature in the book could not be taken as ground for human experience. That it was just one type of human experience. And so he already set out in a letter to Pound, I believe in 52, what he called a book he was doing on the Gutenberg era.
Yeah.
And the Gutenberg era was going to try to grapple with the different technologies that underlie human expression. So then you go from 52 to 54, 55, when he gets a hold of the notion of acoustic space, and then he begins to see how the symmetries can be used not only objectively but also subjectively in terms of ear and eye. And so by the end of that decade, he's gotten fairly clear in his mind that there are structures that are just as true of human seeing as they are of what humans see. And he then has 20 years to live, and what he tries to do is refine that one insight.
Right. Okay, so let's leave it at that, because you have to go. We went a little over because we started late, but we got our usual at least two hours in.
Yes,
so,
sir.
Very good. Again,
all right, thanks, Bob.
Notice how much talking you're doing.
That's right, too much.
No, it's good. All right, so thank you very much, and we'll continue next week.
Yep, look forward. Thanks, Bob. Bye-bye.
Okay, Cameron. Bye.